Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 146 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. Listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Before we get to our long interview today, a shout out to Martin Barnes, who has committed to a monthly donation on Patreon.com. You too can do the same thing. Welcome to the show, Eric. So today I'd like to start by talking about Brzezinski's recent hearing before the Texas Medical Board. So maybe you can first start by telling us, what is the Texas Medical Board?
Sure. I mean, every state in the country has a medical board. It's the organization that certifies your medical license and can also hold the power to remove it if proper proceedings have gone underway. The Texas Medical Board, in relation to Brzezinski, they've tried and failed to remove his medical license since the 1980s. This is like the 20th time, nearly two dozen times. Not all of them made it its way to court, but they did attempt nearly two dozen times to remove his license, and this was just the latest one. And of course, they failed at that. This one as well.
Right. So. A lot of these boards kind of have a division between their employees of the boards who do the administrative work, and then there are, at the hearings, they bring in, say, doctors who are members of the Texas Medical Council or something like that. Is that how the Texas Medical Board works?
Pretty much. It is rather confusing. When a complaint is filed, there might not even be the same group of people on the board when the complaint's filed versus the people on the board when the thing is all wrapping up. But yeah, it goes in front of more than one administrative law judge. The board hires what they call their staff attorneys. They have their staff attorneys on staff to investigate whatever alleged complaint has been sort of turned in. And in Texas, especially in Brzezinski's case, the so-called complaint is the greatest way to try to knock out competition, particularly Brzezinski. So that's one of the reasons they've been utilizing it for so long.
It hasn't worked, right? It's caused him a lot of grief. It's obviously not a perfect way to do it. Otherwise, Brzezinski would have been long gone.
Right. Yeah, it drains him of more money, wears him down more, But yeah, so then it goes through, in this case, it was November 2015 was kind of like the, quote, prosecution side of the trial, which is a week of just them, with their so-called expert witnesses, saying as many bad things and, about Brzezinski and, making him look like a horrible person. And then the following spring was the sort of defense side of the trial for a week.
Right.
And then most recently, I guess it was May of this year, not that long ago, it was like the sort of final meeting that the judges came to the conclusion that this guy not only is a significant contributor to the future cancer therapy, but he wasn't doing half of what they claimed he was doing wrong. And it was actually one of the more successful trials ever, where they just went or kind of sat back and looked at the board, kind of scratching their head, going, "What on earth are you doing? None of this is relevant, and all of this is rather insane."
What were some of the major components of the complaint against Brzezinski, and who originated the complaint?
That's a good question. I don't know who originated the complaint. I'm not sure if he does either, because they can do anonymous complaints.
Right.
And once the thing starts building, it becomes like a life of its own.
Mm-hmm.
But they tried to get him. The most common things were things like standard of care. He was practicing outside of the standard of care, which is one of the most abstract, bizarre, kind of labels. So that means anything that isn't the status quo, anything that isn't, it's so abstract. It's kind of hard. What does that mean?
Right. Well, I mean, as an example in cancer, throughout most of the 20th century, the standard of care for women with breast cancer was a total mastectomy. Remove both breasts entirely.
Right.
And that was the standard of care for many years. And if you did anything else, you would lose your license. But then gradually people start to say, what's the justification for this? What's the proof that if we remove both breasts, you're actually less likely to have cancer? You have all of these other problems that originate from having your breasts removed, apart from just the psychological aspect. And then eventually they said, well, you know, there's really no reason to do this unless the cancer spread throughout both breasts, right?
Right.
But that was the standard of care upon which you could be destroyed as a doctor.
Yep.
Most people think, okay, standard of care, that means you're not a good doctor, right? But it just means you're not following the majority opinion, which may be a wrong opinion.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's a lot of the trial arguing about exactly that. They weren't allowed to say the names of the patients. It was like patient A, patient G, blah, blah. Mm. There was also, he owned a pharmacy that's on the same property of the clinic. It's the Brzezinski Clinic, the Brzezinski Pharmacy, and they somehow decided that Brzezinski was hiding his financial interest in the pharmacy, which, again, is another abstract one.
Is it really called the Brzezinski Pharmacy?
I don't know. I've never actually.
I was going to say, if you're trying to hide your financial interest in a pharmacy and you give it your own name, that's you're not doing a very good job.
Yeah. I mean, it is. There's a building that houses only his clinic. At least last time I was there. And,
yeah.
And of course, it has like a little cafeteria that he owns, and there's a pharmacy, you know, that he owns. So of course, even before the thing went to trial, because this is one of the charges, a giant plaque was placed next to the door saying this pharmacy is owned by Dr. Brzezinski, you know. It's not worth going to court over, but if you want us to put a sign there, we'll be happy to do it. Stuff like that.
Oh, so that was the remediation of that was the solution of the problem, is that a big sign saying Dr. Brzezinski owns this pharmacy.
Right. And
I mean, I think from a point of view of anybody who's involved in anything slightly alternative, and maybe we'll get into what Brzezinski does in a little while, but I know of other cases where there, you know, when you're seen as the bad boy and the whole medical establishment against you, a lot of people don't want to play ball with you. So you might find that pharmacies don't really want to sell to your customers because they are scared of being associated with you, right? They're scared of losing their license. If something goes wrong and I sold the drugs to Brzezinski, then I'm going to get shut down too, right? So it makes sense for a guy like this to own his own pharmacy so he can be guaranteed that his patients can get what they need.
Yeah, sure. Because a lot of the therapy, aside from, I mean, somebody might need some allergy medication or whatever, it's mm-hmm. all there in the pharmacy, kind of like a miniature CVS. But aside from his original medication that he invented, sometimes his therapy involves sort of a combination of various cancer drugs that he kind of creatively designs. He needs a pharmacy.
Nobody else is going to dispense those. I mean, let's talk about that. He calls his therapies, I'm not sure if they should be called drugs, anti-neoplastons, which just means anti-cancer, so it's not terribly informative. Mm-hmm. If I remember right, I mean, he's been doing this since the 90s or the 80s?
Since the late 70s.
He extracted certain compounds from urine at one point, but mm-hmm. now they're synthesized, right?
Compounds? Yeah, the gist of it is like most scientific innovations, it was an accidental find. He found a strain of peptides in people's blood and urine that had never been discovered before. As one guy put it, it was like finding a bunch of new islands off the coast of Miami, just like this huge discovery. And so after he continued with this discovery and just testing the peptide levels in different people, different races, different sexes, whatever, he found that people with cancer had a really low count of these newly discovered peptides. And that's kind of where it all began. And he started, he realized there was a relationship to cancer, you know, in the early 70s, and the National Cancer Institute in the United States was funding him, not like a lot, but it was, you know, significant grant funding to study
right.
it. And he could isolate them and did it in blood first. Then, of course, realizing the amount of blood you'd need to isolate them, it just went on to urine because it was the only other, you know, major sort of liquid bodily fluid source, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So, yeah. It was kind of comical. He would have huge vats of urine container vats, like at parks and prisons or anywhere you can collect a lot of it, and have these big gasoline-sized trucks, you know, truck it in. to his manufacturing facilities. But anyway, that jumped ahead. But yes, but now he synthesizes them. So by the 80s, because he's also a biochemist, he figured out isolated what the chemicals were and found a way to synthesize them. So they don't. Okay. He doesn't need to do that anymore.
Yes. But I've always tried to struggle. I learned about Brzezinski the first time. There's a book by, I think, Ralph Moss called The Cancer Industry, which I think was published in the 90s, and as a second edition came out. And they talked about a lot of people who, with non-mainstream cancer therapies. I hesitate to call Brzezinski alternative because he's not really in the category of like herbal remedies or anything like that. It's still a very scientific kind of approach. And it's even, I believe, patented. But one thing it's not is highly toxic. And it also seems in some people to be much more effective than alternatives, say people with brain cancer or things where the mainstream offers you basically nothing, right? Like the chances of you, if you have a brain tumor, the chances of being alive a year from now or with mainstream therapy, including radiation to the brain and chemotherapy and stuff, the chances of you being alive a year from now are very small. And the chances, if you're alive, the chances of you enjoying your life are even smaller.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, you're exactly right. It is a legitimate invention that, you know, was developed in a lab and is patented. It's gone through FDA clinical trials, which is kind of unheard of for an individual scientist that's kind of competing with pharma. But the only reason he's gotten into clinical trials was because he defeated them in federal court, you know, the FDA themselves twice.
Right.
When they tried their hand at going after them, and that whole thing backfired on them. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely within the pharmaceutical grade world. It is a little more cumbersome to administer. Well, there is a pill form of it. He doesn't really use like a straight injectable form that you would traditionally would get. You carry this pump around 24 hours a day.
Right.
With the two types of medications in it. What's called a Hickman line installed into the chest. That's, you know, and that's how it's administered. So.
So is it infused into a vein or into the abdominal cavity?
I'm not sure. I can't remember the name of the vein, but yeah, it's some certain type of vein that, yeah, it's going right into.
And how long do people need to do this? Because it doesn't go on forever, does it?
It depends on the person. It's very individual in that way. One patient, Jody Fenton, who had a brain tumor, it was gone in 3 months. Didn't need it more than that. And then, she switched the pill form as a maintenance. While some of the other extremes end of the spectrum, this is like a guy named Paul Michaels. I think he was on it for 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
Until the brain tumor went away. So these are,
I mean, some people would say, well, gee, if he'd gone to the MD Anderson Cancer Clinic, which is the competition, right? That's the truly mainstream cancer hospital in Texas.
Yeah, in his neck of the woods, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people would say, well, if he'd gone there, he would have got, you know, the guy would have lasted more than 4 years. But actually, Brzezinski has had people come to him who've been pretty near the end of their rope, right? Like, they've been through chemotherapy and stuff, and the doctors are starting to say, look, you need to, like, write your will and get all your things together and say goodbye to all your friends because you don't have much time.
I mean, I don't know. It's kind of funny when he was, like the argument you're making about how people say, oh, they would have lasted longer. I mean, all of his patients are diagnosed at third-party institutions like MD Anderson, you know.
Right.
Very often, there are a lot of people out there that are courageous enough to just say no to all therapy and then go to Brzezinski, but most of these people are told, there's nothing for you. Our staff showed this or that, and, you know, even if you did this, you're not going to live anyway. So he gets all kinds. But sometimes there are people that have gone in and failed everything, and they're just sort of, you know, emaciated and not in great health at all. Other people that are early on, even though they're told, you know, they're terminal, like say with an inoperable brain tumor, and go to him. He doesn't cure all of them. He hasn't been able to. But if you consider, you know, the other options.
I mean, that's funny. I mean, if you prosecuted cancer doctors because the first time one of their patients died, there would be no cancer doctors.
Yeah. It's interesting. This is one of the great examples. This one guy that was like patient F, I believe, in the trial, and he had stage 4 pancreatic cancer. This is what Steve Jobs died of, Patrick Swayze died of. I mean, this is like...
Right, stage 4 pancreatic cancer
Yeah.
is basically you're going to be dead soon, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that's...
I mean, yeah. Usually it's diagnosed very, very late. There's not many symptoms, and it's just, yeah, I mean, you look at somebody with resources like Jobs or Swayze, and they didn't make it. And so many people, I have one aunt who, you know, was just diagnosed and gone in a matter of months. Anyway, this guy goes to Brzezinski. He's told that, you know, he's going to die. Chemotherapy is not going to save your life. They go to Brzezinski, and they get his personalized sort of gene-targeted therapy where he takes your biopsy sample, has it sent to different labs, and tests the genes. And it came back with, you know, and the whole point is that it comes back with telling you what drugs you think may or may not be helpful in this case. So this guy got kind of lucky with his genetic makeup. He prescribed him a handful of gene-targeted drugs. Within weeks, the tumor is basically gone. The guy goes home, I think somewhere, I don't know, somewhere in the mid-south, mid-middle, like one of the Carolinas or Virginia, tells his oncologist what he's been doing. The oncologist says, you know, what, are you crazy? You're spending all this money on these drugs? I could have gotten you these drugs and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And basically convinces the guy that Brzezinski is like a total scam artist. And even though his cancer was gone, and he was one of the patients that testified in the trial against Dr. B, a survived, a stage 4 pancreatic cancer patient that survived, that just had the wool pulled over his eyes by his local oncologist. The same oncologist, by the way, that said you were going to die. And he's been cancer-free now for more than 5 years now, this guy.
That is almost unbelievable. the power of the medical establishment is really incredible. It's mm-hmm. it's like people have absorbed the propaganda for so many years. I mean, I'm 60 now. I can remember as a child, I was always really interested. I did things like read the newspaper that most, you know, 8 or 9 year olds wouldn't do, but I can remember articles, you know, basically saying, you know, scientists have discovered a new compound that has stopped tumors in mice. You know, it's expected that this could lead in the future to the development of new drugs that might lead to finally a cure for cancer. And this was like the 1960s, and I'm reading the same articles today. Somebody just sent me one the mm-hmm. other day that there's been this new earth-shaking discovery about what cancer cells do, and that we can have targeted therapy against it. And I know that either it's going to completely disappear, or they're going to come up with drugs that are highly toxic that give you like an extra day or an extra week of life and make your whatever you have left miserable. That's the reality.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Basically, people get kind of get taken aback when I'm so like matter of fact about it. But really, it's not like a bunch of guys, you know, conspiring to do this. But the system is not designed to make these giant leaps scientifically. And there are plenty of scientists that have made these huge leaps scientifically, and sometimes their discoveries get out into the press. But just as you said it best, you'll notice that they will eventually go away, and you'll never hear from them again. And that's one of the reasons, too, why you haven't really had a giant, massive medical breakthrough in more than 50 years, except for, like, say, penicillin or insulin. What has there really been?
I don't think there has been. People talk about the miracles of modern medicine. And I think in terms of physical medicine, like where we've gone with like treating people with burns or, you know, bashed up bodies and things like that. I mean, war-like medicine has always been a big success. Of course, if we didn't have wars, we wouldn't have so many issues with people getting blown apart. But, I mean, America's the best country, in a sense, to get shot by a gun because doctors know how to deal with these massive wounds that you have and with all the problems that you have, right? That seems to be pretty successful. But when it comes to, like when you, we'll talk about the stem cells later, but when you talk to somebody who's got cancer or somebody who is depressed or somebody has a neurological disorder, there's very little modern medicine can add, and it's certainly not miracles, right? There might be drugs that slightly improve your life, that reduce the symptoms, that increase your lifespan a little bit, but they're not really dramatic.
Mm. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. So just where I sit, I feel like just looking at the past history, anyone that's made a huge leap forward has been marginalized and slowed down, and it's only the drugs that are kind of barely better than what's already on the market that are freshly new, have new patents and a bunch of lawyers to defend them. And those are the ones that are championed.
That was basically That was basically the message of Ralph Moss's book, The Cancer Industry, which I think is a real classic, because he described a wide variety of cancer therapies over the 20th century, from Brzezinski to Laertl to others like that. And he described, you know, some of the successes these therapies had had. He wasn't like, these things work in every person all the time, but they seem to have a lot more success than the mainstream. And they all had in common, they weren't toxic, some couldn't be patented, and they were all drummed out of business. So why did they hate Brzezinski so much when he actually had a patentable therapy? You'd think that everybody would want to, you know, wrap it in plastic and sell it at a high price to cancer patients.
Yeah. First of all, the Ralph Moss book, Cancer Industry, was what got me into this whole world as well. And I don't know if you knew it, my third movie was about, it's called Second Opinion. It's about Ralph's story at Sloan Kettering.
And Laertl, yes. I don't think I've seen that, but I have read a little bit about that story.
Yeah, cool. It's on Amazon Prime. In fact, most of my films are on Amazon Prime for free, if you remember. But why they hate Brzezinski, because there's so many levels to that. First of all, he didn't go into the, quote, into the fold in the late 70s when they wanted him to and decided to go it alone. Then they really thought that they were going to just get rid of this guy after one state investigation or one federal investigation, that they never not gotten rid of somebody like him, and they just kept failing. So it's just the sort of, if you want to call it hatred, just kept compiling. So that, like, it's gotten to the point today where if his drug was approved, so let's just say for something that's called a DIPG or a diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma, it sounds complicated, but basically, you know, only 400 children in the United States get this type of brain tumor. It grows in the brainstem.
Mm-hmm.
And 90% of these kids are dead by 2 years of diagnosis, and there's not a single one of them that have lived to 5 years based on the standard of care. You know, so just take it for a minute and say, okay, Brzezinski has proven to cure this tumor type in FDA sanctioned and supervised clinical trials, published in the peer-reviewed literature. You know, this was the type of tumor that he was given permission for the final phase of randomized testing, which is a whole other story that no hospital in America, no children's hospital, would allow them to be done on their property. But if it gets into the market, there's two things that will happen. One is they're going to have to admit that all the lies and propaganda were just that, you know, that all that crap they spun about them. And then secondly, what the biggest fear is, when something is on the market and approved, it's on the market. Even if it's not approved for, say, lung or liver or pancreatic cancer, if somebody wants it for that, and they can insist on it, and they can get it, and they can pay out of pocket and get it, and that is when the tide starts to turn. When it goes from, like, a drug that's illegal to possess, you know, like heroin,
right.
The way they treat it, you know, to a drug that's approved, and even if it isn't for that specific condition, that is the next stage. Like, all these great laws, all the pharma lobbyists and all the companies spending all this money to lobby Congress to, like, loosen up all the laws, they could use their own ammunition against them.
So right. I mean, off-label usage is a big problem in medicine in some ways, right? Like doctors will take, you know, antipsychotics that have been tested on adults, and they'll use them on old people and children, or they'll use them for a different disease, right? They'll use them for a different condition that has never been tried for. And drug companies sometimes subtly send these hints that, you know, you should try using it for this illness, even though it was never tested for that, because they see profits to be made, right? They turn a blind eye to this. It's perfectly legal. If a doctor says, I think, you know, this antidepressant's going to be good for your skin problems, then fine, right?
Right.
Fine. So it has its downside, but it does allow a therapy once used to be used pretty much for anything, especially if the word gets around.
And new cancer drugs, that's sort of like the name of the game, like a drug called Avastin. It was originally, it's like a blockbuster, you know, billion-dollar drug that was originally approved for breast cancer. But then somehow they, you know, started using it off-label for all kinds of things. And Brzezinski does the same thing, by the way. He'll give someone Avastin if their genes make sense for that person. But then once it's being used off-label by the mainstream guys long enough, then you can start applying for, you know, approval. So every drug company would love to have their drug be the go-to cancer treatment, you know, for all cancers, you know. So anyway, yeah.
I mean, what is the cost of, I mean, it's hard to say what the cost of Brzezinski's treatment would be because he's paying for a lot of legal bills that he wouldn't normally have to pay for. But I mean, what is the sort of the cost of what Brzezinski's treatment is versus, say, if you go to MD Anderson Cancer Center and get treated for the same?
It's a little bit depending on the patient, but let's just say you're just going to get antineoplastons and only that.
Right.
It's roughly like $17,000 to get started, and then something around $7,000 to $10,000 a month after that. That's pretty much, from what I understand, pretty much including everything. But again, everybody's different, so it's not, you know, that's just what I was aware of as of like less than a year ago.
Right.
So yeah, if you're on it for a year, you're looking at easily, you know, around $100,000. But like I have a family member who, well, my mom, I'll just say it, got diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian last summer. She's cancer-free today, partly with the help of what Brzezinski does. It's a whole much longer story. But the reason I brought it up is because, like, the surgery alone was, you know, nearly $100,000. Each round, she did chemo based upon her genetic testing, so it's not quite as awful as it sounds. It's, you know, the dangerous, evil chemo, which most of it is. But it was like $75,000 a round. And three of those make one, something like that. It was outrageous. So in a matter of like weeks, you know, she managed to outspend what a Brzezinski patient would spend. But the difference being that insurance will cover it going to the usual like UCLA versus.
Right. So yeah. Even if it's less with Brzezinski, if it's not covered by insurance, I mean, that seems to be a little bit of a scam, is that if it wasn't for insurance companies, these expensive therapies would basically have died away because nobody's, you know, I shouldn't say nobody's got 100,000. There are a few people in America, the 1%, who could afford 100,000. And there might be another 1% who could like mortgage everything to pay for a therapy that expensive. And the rest of people, even middle-class people, it would destroy them, right? Halfway through treatment, they would have run out of money. They would have sold their house. They would have sold everything. And they end up dead and with a family that's bankrupt. I mean, it still happens because not everything's covered by insurance or government medicine in the United States. But if it's totally not covered by insurance, then you're really screwed.
Yeah, it's just, especially like say something like with Medicare, because it's so set in stone. You know, Bush kind of introduced the, I can't remember what it's called, back in his administration in 2003, and then Obama just, you know, nailed it. Shut quite nicely with Obamacare. And I'm not against either one of them. I'm just saying that that's, again, kind of like what they do behind the scenes, where once you get something like Medicare in place or good insurance in place, then they can start charging whatever they want. Like in the case of Medicare, it's great for them because it's the state paying for most of these drugs, so they could just name their prices.
Well, I remember when there was a law passed, this was a long time ago, maybe 20 years ago, that basically said Medicare is not allowed to negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical companies. Because, like in Canada, even though drugs are not covered by the Canadian healthcare system, except when you're in a hospital, what that means is the hospitals have this huge buying power. And that drives down the cost of drugs for everybody, right? Because that's sort of, everybody knows what the wholesale cost is, right? Like you can't maintain a hugely high retail cost. So costs for everybody are lower in Canada because the hospitals and the provincial drug plans and things like that can negotiate. But in the United States, they can't. So I guess they get away with anything. But I mean, it does surprise me that somebody asked me this the other day, is like many of these alternative therapies, maybe not for cancer, but for a lot of things, like let's say depression, right? If you take an alternative therapy, maybe talk therapy plus herbs or something like that, it may be just as effective or more effective than pharmaceutical antidepressants and a lot cheaper. Why do the drug companies insist on paying for the more expensive thing? It's a mystery. Why do they insist on paying for chemotherapy even when the benefits to the patient are minimal?
Yeah, that's the way the system was constructed. You know, it's just create a system that is fertile ground for that. Caters to everything every reason they exist, I guess you could say. Like for instance, you know, this whole gene testing thing that my mother and many Brzezinski patients go through. Like, the reason you hear about it, and some of the oncologists are aware of it, but the whole thing smacks into the face of everything of how this system has been designed, meaning treating each patient individually. So if you can test somebody to see which chemos or which this drug or that drug will have the most effect on this patient, and then only give them those drugs or a combination of those drugs, then you're turning everything on its head, because the days of opening up the standard of care cookbook, oh, you have this type of cancer, you're supposed to get this, that's gone. And also, the whole clinical testing process is kind of throwing a monkey wrench into that, too, because everybody in the clinical trials treated as a number, they're the same, which made sense for a while until we figured out that that's a bad idea. Everybody's different, you know? So you can't really put together, you can't really move forward in the gene-targeted realm as far as getting drugs approved, per se, because it does two things. First of all, you can't design a clinical trial that's separate for each person. And secondly, you're also letting the cat out of the bag of one of their tactics that I've been doing for years, and that is they know which drugs affect which genes. They intentionally find people, test them first to see if they have one of the genes that are going to react to this drug, get it approved, making on paper looks, wow, this drug works great, which usually, again, it doesn't mean it saved anyone's life. It just extended their life by
right.
3 months, 4 months compared to the last drug. And then once it's on the market, then they give the drug to everybody that has like that type of cancer, you know,
right.
Not even thinking to test the genes for that.
Yeah, it'd be like McDonald's doing research to find out that there's a small percentage of Americans who can eat hamburgers every day and stay healthy, and then sell hamburgers to everybody because that's where the market is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in the end, Brzezinski survived yet another attempt to shut him down. That was the end of this session?
For now, yeah. You know, it's interesting. I don't know. But at the time that I did the movies about him, maybe in 2011 when it really got the movie, the first one was on Netflix and got the most popularity at the time, it's just the more popular he became, the harder they would fight back,
right.
The more crazy he would become. Yeah, I mean, this is just it for now, you know? I mean, well, who knows what's going to come down the pipe.
Do you think people like Patient B, I think it was, the guy whose life was probably saved by Brzezinski, mm-hmm. who then was used to turn on him, do you think that kind of testimony hurt Brzezinski or helped him?
That's a good question. It depends on how deeply someone that's looking at the story looks into it. Because this patient actually, I think he has a website called like Brzezinski Scam or something like that. Like he really took it pretty far. And then these sort of astroturfers, these paid people that, it's a whole other hour conversation really, but there's this, you know, the political parties and definitely pharma, and you know, they will utilize what's called astroturfing, which is now we kind of call it fake news, because the term everybody uses. But, they jumped on this guy and just kept throwing gasoline onto the fire with this guy. And so basically, I think it's easier for people. Let me go back to your question. It depends. If someone spends the time to, like, say, watch some of the footage that I shot of Brzezinski being asked about patient F, and you see how ridiculous it is, then obviously it helps Brzezinski. But if you just, on the surface, think, oh, this guy who was, you know, treated by Brzezinski was supposedly overcharged and, you know, given a bunch of drugs that his local guy could have given him. It's funny, because people will just hear that and then go, oh, Brzezinski's this horrible guy. But they also don't take a step back again and go, well, wait a minute, but why is he still alive and cancer-free 5+ years later, pancreatic cancer? You know, so it just depends on how intelligent the person is looking at it.
Right, and I mean, it's not really true that his local oncologist could have given him those drugs, because if those drugs were anti-neoplastons, I mean, I guess if the oncologist said, well, the anti-neoplastons are just a placebo, and so it's only the other stuff that Brzezinski gave you that had any effect,
it is kind of true. He could have given it to him because what Brzezinski gave him is something that anybody could have access to. But the difference is he would have not known to give it to this guy because mm-hmm. he would have not known to do the genetic testing and do it the way Brzezinski treated this guy. And the guy also, so much has changed. This was like 7 years ago that this patient was treated. Even in that short amount of time, the whole landscape has changed dramatically in relationship to using gene-targeted drugs in relationship to cancer. So, it's more about the guy didn't know any better. But of course, yeah, if he was instructed, you need to buy these drugs for this patient, he could have gotten them. Yes, he could have. But it wouldn't make any difference. Only difference is he probably could have gotten insurance to cover it, you know, which is a whole other thing. Because if you can convince your local oncologist to listen to Brzezinski's advice, buy these drugs for me, please. Your insurance will most likely cover it.
Right, right. There's no prohibition against the drugs. It's just you got to find a doctor to prescribe them. Anyway, let's before we start to run out of time, let's move on to a more recent documentary that you made on stem cells and stem cell therapy, which has been kind of a hot topic for a while. And let's you made a distinction between different types of stem cells: adult stem cells, cord and umbilical stem cells, and fetal and embryonic stem cells. Because can we define some terms to start with? Like, what are the different kinds of stem cells?
Sure.
Where they come from?
Yeah, one of the biggest hurdles in making this movie was to try to help the audience understand that they're not all the same. So you have something like embryonic, which is confused with fetal. Embryonic is something that is, it's a stem cell that's grown, or an embryo grown in a petri dish. It takes about 5 days to grow it. It's no organs have been formed yet, nothing of the sort. Again, it's just grown in a lab. They've been, you know, using embryonic cells and studying them for a long time. and they're actually supposedly one of the more dangerous ones, where because they're so, I don't know what the word would be, but because they're so powerful, A, but B, they haven't really been alive long enough to really go in a certain direction. They're not building organs yet. They are the ones that theoretically can cause cancer if injected into the system, but that you don't really know what you're doing. And again, because they haven't really formed much of anything, they can become just about anything. And that isn't always a good thing in the world of stem cells. So, but embryonic and fetal, which is what my movie was about, are cells harvested at the end of the first trimester. And what also makes it kind of more confusing is that much of the world doesn't have a vocabulary word for fetal, and it's all embryonic, all the same. So when it's not, scientifically the same thing. So there's that. Then there's the most popular, other than adult.
I mean, it's a continuum, adults, right? Yeah. But you start when the sperm and the egg fuse, you have an embryo, right?
Yeah.
And a fetus is a child that's not yet been born. So there's kind of overlap between those two things. But you wouldn't talk about a one-day-old baby as an embryo, right? As a fetus.
Yeah.
Pardon me. So you wouldn't talk about a fetus. You'd say it was an embryo, and at some point it becomes a fetus. But it's not really a specific hard line, right? There's no.
Yeah. Which because it's such a new field, it also becomes very arbitrary. Who decides what point it becomes a fetus? Even another company out of San Diego, when they treated, they got kind of famous by treating hockey legend Gordie Howe with fetal cells. They got a lot of flack for using fetal, and then they decided to call it adult, and decided to just move the goalposts and say, oh, no, where we harvest our cells are considered adult, even though it's in the womb, you know. So, anyway, I know it's just making it more confusing. And then you have, umbilical, which is very popular. People have a child, and they save their umbilical cord cells, and
right.
It's basically just, you know, blood stem cells. So, and then there's adult, which can be taken from your fat or from your bone marrow. So now that you've heard all that, then to try to make it a little more simplified, I'll go back again. You hear most about are the adult or the autologous cells, which is probably the least expensive and the easiest to have access to. But there's some good and bad sides to these cells. They're not going to kill you or anything, but if you're like a 50 or 60-year-old person and you're getting adult autologous stem cell therapy, you're getting your cells taken from your fat or your bone marrow, being processed and given back to you. And the idea, hopefully, is they go in and regenerate wherever they go around your body, whether it be your heart or your lungs or whatever, they regenerate your body. But these cells are just as old as you are. They're 55 years old. Even though they're a stem cell, they haven't really become something yet, theoretically. They're activated in such a way where they go in. But if you have to think about it, if you wanted them to be a brain cell or a heart cell or a liver cell, that's kind of a lot of work for them to go through. Not that they can't do it. That's what they do. But you compare that to a 50 to 60-year-old cell that has been taken from you and processed, and then you're hoping, let's just say you have a neurological issue or whatever it is, those cells still have to, like, kind of do God's work, which is kind of, ironically why I call the movie the God cells, and transform and, take advantage of their biology to become that regenerative cell. But if you take a fetal cell that already is a heart cell or a brain cell or a liver cell, et cetera, because in the case of the Ukrainians that I focus on primarily, that's exactly what they do. So I'll back up for a minute on that. Then there's another complication to it, and that is genetic matching. The adult cells work well because of the genetic genetic matching is never an issue.
Right. The same with umbilical, right? Like it's if you save it from your baby and then you use it later when that baby's grown up for some reason, then it's obviously the same person.
Yep.
So you don't have a problem
exactly.
That way.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting because your body will theoretically reject those cells if it's not the same person. But what's interesting about fetal is you have this kind of magical time period. I hate to use the word magical, but you know, and they're the first trimester where these guys figured out that there is no rejection, there is no genetic matching required. For some bizarre reason, especially at this time period, they can be, again, you don't want to just haphazardly inject them. They're tested for every disease and bacteria under the sun, of course, but for whatever reason, they just graft. They're just smart enough to know. All they know is that they're a giant fetus, basically. You know, they're injected into
right.
you, and they go in and start repairing things.
And how do they know that they've really become part of your body?
I know it's kind of even the experts don't really have a full understanding. They just know what they don't do. So it's kind of again why I called it the God cells, because I couldn't think of a better name, because it's just like it's just biology. They just know where to go and what to do. Like,
but I mean, can they prove later that you know, let's say somebody has these and then later they die, and could on an autopsy, could you see where these cells had actually become part of your heart or become part of your liver or whatever part of your body was having problems?
Yes and no. So to answer your question, one of the things that they started figuring out that this is solid science is that mothers who would sort of donate their bodies to science, if you would, like early on, they'd have children, and when they died, they would autopsy them, and they found that, you know, obviously female mother who gave birth to male boys, it was male DNA, I believe it was. It was a part of the male fetus, you know, the stem cells that were in the woman's heart, in her brain, and other parts of her body, that they could prove that this was a reality. So and even though this kid in the womb is technically, genetically, that's probably the closest thing to the mom you're going to get, but it's still not genetically matched. It's still got a different male, you know, the sperm was from a different male unmatched, you know, just because there's probably a different blood type. Just because you're a child doesn't mean you're going to be able to be like a candidate for a kidney transplant or something like that.
Right,
know?
Right.
So, yeah, so it's kind of proven the point that even in the womb, this genetically unmatched thing protects the mother.
That is interesting, and it also goes to illustrate that our understanding of biology is highly simplistic, because mm-hmm. you know, we have these one-way things. You know, the mother and father produce material that make the baby, but the thought that some of the material from the baby goes back to the mother is, you know, kind of breaks that rule. Just like, for example, you know, DNA produces RNA has always been the rule, but we've known for a long time, at least since the 70s, that RNA can also produce DNA. And so once you break these rules of kind of these linear rules, then things become a whole lot more complicated. It's a lot harder to understand biology, but denying reality is not a good idea either.
Right, right. But yeah, I mean, I'm happy to answer more questions about stem cells. It's just so it is confusing. It's hard to kind of organize it all. Is that a lot of people they just lump it all together, and it's not their fault, but just the whole world of stem cells, people just kind of glaze over, you know.
Well, one thing people don't glaze over about and get really excited about is the fact that fetal stem cells come from aborted babies, and in mm-hmm. America in particular, abortion is an extremely hot topic, and I kind of got the feeling you'd got some pushback because you're really focusing on fetal stem cells, and I guess in Mexico and the Ukraine, abortions are relatively unregulated, unlike in the United States.
Well, first of all, the only place on planet Earth that it is actually legal, where the law is on the books to do this, is Ukraine. It's not legal in Mexico. It's not legal in China or India and a lot of these other places that they're allegedly doing it. That's one. But number two, yeah, I felt like, first of all, this story had it all. Everything that I've worked, kind of investigated and done with the Brzezinski story and the Ralph Moss story, you not only have something, this is like the polar opposite of, say, the Brzezinski story in the sense that no matter what anyone would do, you can't patent this therapy at all. I mean, it's not even like on the table. People could try to patent a way to replicate the cells, which, you know, where you don't necessarily need the abortion, but then that gets hairy because the so-called experts say, no, you're not supposed to replicate them. You got to use fresh ones. It's the safest and most efficacious way to do it. Then even if somebody did find a way to patent the replication of them, I mean, there's a million ways you can replicate them. You're just going to do all the work for all your competition by spending all this money and time. And as soon as you get your, say, stem cell therapy approved for, say, Parkinson's or whatever, you just open the floodgates for all of your competition. You did all the time and spent all the money for them. You know what I mean? So that's sort of like when people say you can't patent it, that's what we're talking about. Because if in a truly, you know, competitive capitalist society, the last thing you're going to do is do all the work for your competition. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
So you have that, and then you have, and by the way, too, like, what's great about this is the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, or CIRM. I had them in the movie, and they've been around for nearly a decade, or more than a decade, with billions of dollars behind them, and they're facing the same problem. They sat there in their big annual board meeting complaining, basically, that the FDA and industry have made their lives nearly impossible.
Well, this is one commonality with Brzezinski, is the role of the FDA in enforcing orthodoxy.
Yeah. So in stem cells, it's even more frightening. And I think they love the fact, first of all, that it's so confusing. And, of course, this with the whole abortion issue adding to it, it just makes sure no one gets anywhere near it. You know. But anyway, you have something that not only one person can't own, so you're automatically just disqualifying it to, like, really reach the market. And then secondly, you're talking about something that it's like almost sounds like science fiction, where it replaces like a whole class of drugs. Where if you're diagnosed with Parkinson's and you get these like fetal stem cells every 4 to 6 months until that levels out, what's the need for ever needing a drug again for Parkinson's ever? And if you have a stroke and these cells are like in the ambulance on call, injected into the person minutes after having a stroke, and reducing the side effects from that stroke. And what do you need after all the other drugs?
I think one thing I felt watching the movie is that you didn't cover was the fact that not only were these people taking stem cells, but in many cases they were stopping their medication. And I felt that a lot of these people were true believers in the medical system, who had Parkinson's, and they'd done whatever their doctor had said, and they'd taken these drugs, and they were getting worse, and they were assuming their Parkinson's were getting worse rather than the medications were exacerbating their condition. And so one of the factors when you take an alternative therapy that you truly believe in is you stop taking the pharmaceutical drugs that may just be harming you. And that's a kind of, it's hard in these cases of examples of people who have these benefits. It's hard to say it was all due to the stem cells, because some of it might have been just due to, like, one kid couldn't study, right? Well, he stopped all his medications after taking stem cells. So was it the stem cells that did it, or was it the stopping the medication?
Good point. Yeah, good point.
I mean, I'm not saying that could explain everything, because I think the stories you had of interviewing with people who'd had these experiences, I mean, in many cases, it's pretty unlikely that just stopping their medications would have suddenly brought them back to health. But particularly with that one boy who was having trouble studying, I thought he could be a classic kid. He'd been put on every psychological drug that was around by the psychiatrist, by parents who believed we've got to do more to help our son, give him more and more stuff. And only because they truly believed in stem cells did they then have the courage to stop the drugs.
Mm-hmm. It could be. You're right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. I mean, yeah. Like little things that unrelated to the drugs happened, like because he had like kind of an overactive bladder for most
right,
of his life.
Right.
And he didn't. There was no drugs to solve that. And that went away within a couple months. And then he was complaining about having hideous bacterial acne. I was taking Accutane at the highest dose, and all the acne went away.
Right.
While stopping the medication. So, yeah, it kind of goes both directions. Were those antipsychotic kind of ADD, ADHD drugs, which are hideous? I mean, but by the way, I'm pretty much convinced that all these, like, you know, a sudden surge of school shootings, you know, things like that, are because of the onslaught of these drugs given to our teenagers.
Yeah. There's been a lot of attention in Canada to a soldier who came back from Afghanistan, totally traumatized by a lot of things he he'd seen some of his buddies were blown up with an IED. He'd been carrying around a lot of dead bodies of people killed by one side or the other. He'd seen a lot of horrible things, and he came back, and he ended up shooting his wife, his child, his mother, and himself in this horrible mass shooting. But wow. Reading this article, it's like he was on this cornucopia of pharmaceuticals, right? Antipsychotics, antidepressants, all these things. And some of those have violent behavior as a side effect. So you're giving this guy who's struggling with the violence he saw in Afghanistan, you're giving him drugs that can cause this. And nowhere in the newspaper article, of course, did it mention that possibly they could have contributed to his violent outburst. It's like they didn't create his PTSD, but they might have exacerbated it.
Right.
Which seems beyond the pale in North America, that you cannot say that a pharmaceutical drug given for a condition might actually make it worse. That's just, you're not allowed to say that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, you have, I don't know, radiation and chemotherapy are the two biggest carcinogenic things on the planet, and they're given to cancer patients who just got cancer. Yeah, I don't know. The whole opioid antipsychotic world is very fascinating. I haven't spent much time in that world as I have in the other subjects of
well,
my movies. But
definitely a movie there.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a cash cow, I mean, for the industry, these drugs. I mean, it's huge.
It is. I mean, but the thing is, it's kind of like robbery, right? Like you bash in somebody's house, you do $3,000 worth of damage, and you steal $3,000 worth of stuff, and you sell it for $300. So to you, you've made a $300 profit, but to the person who's affected by the robbery, you've lost them $6,000.
Yeah.
And a lot of medicine seems to be like that. In order to make a profit of $1 billion, they're creating a $10 billion or $100 billion problem for society. You've got all the crime that's created by all of these addicts, all these people who are dying early, the people who can't work, you know, the people that don't care about their living environment, so they let their house go and all this kind of stuff. Like, there's the consequences of these things, are ramifications are enormous, so that you can make this, it seems like a big profit, but in the grand scheme of things, you're creating a negative value, which is much bigger than the profit you're making.
I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, like, something so small and simple, too, is, like, say, Medicare again. You have people living in low income that have Medicare. They will get these drugs prescribed to them because of the resale value, you know?
Well, yeah, plus, if you have people like former soldiers or people on Medicare, you're trying to minimize the cost. It's much easier to give them a prescription to a drug than it is to say, you know, what you need is 3 years of talk therapy, and then maybe you can get over your trauma, right? That would probably cost more, so you're going to get prescribed drugs. That's the easy thing. Come into Veterans Affairs, come out with a prescription, right? As opposed to twice a week, we want you to go to a psychiatrist, to go to group therapy, to go all of these different things that might be more effective, but more expensive, so they don't get done. Or they're just not available because you live, you know, it takes you 2 hours to get to the hospital's going to treat you. And so where are you going to do, you know, maybe there isn't a psychiatrist near you or something like that who could do this. But for whatever reasons, drugs seem to be the go-to, because you can go to any pharmacy in any little town in America and get potent drugs.
Yep.
Another issue I had with the film was that you documented yourself getting therapy at the clinic in the Ukraine.
Yep.
And I just kind of thought that was a little bit of a conflict of interest, that you were receiving therapy from this hospital. To me, it made it seem like you had, an ulterior motive to make them look good, which maybe doesn't really help the film. That's what I thought.
Yeah, well, I started out following that one guy who was doing it in Tijuana. And then throughout the process, there were some pretty remarkable patients. But for the process, my antennas went up, and I just didn't. This kind of goes both ways, where I didn't want to make a movie only focusing on him.
Right.
And I knew that he had discovered it from the Ukrainians, but I didn't know the depth of it or really much about it. And I reached out to them originally, the Ukrainians, and they kind of blew me off. They didn't want to have anything to do with me. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I think it was because of my relationship with this other person.
Okay. Bad blood.
Yeah. But I didn't tell every detail like that in the movie itself. But there was two reasons why I did it. One was, A, like, how often do I get a chance to participate in what it is I'm investigating versus mm-hmm. being an onlooker? And B, I've met enough people that had been through the therapy that they talked about how much it benefited them. To be honest, I almost started getting jealous. Like, people that were not sick that would just get on for, like, anti-aging and longevity and health reasons. And I just said, you know, and a lot of these people were, like, very busy professionals taking on a lot at once, and that's sort of completely described me. And then lastly, one of the reasons I really kind of focused on them is because of what I said earlier, that it's the only place in the world that's completely doing this above board, where they're right. not avoiding regulations, which just will automatically breed corruption, even in the smallest, you know, scale of corruption.
Right.
You don't really know. There's no transparency like anywhere else you'd go get these things,
right.
except this place. And I just, yeah, and it was kind of like, it was kind of like my kind of negotiating, get myself in. So look, not only what if I got the therapy and I documented every step of the way, you know, what it would be like to go through this experience. And then of course they didn't, you know, that took us some time to gain their trust to let me do that. And it wasn't until after that process that I started showing these interesting improvements that I kind of like negotiated with them, like, can I please see your lab? You know, that was not an easy task.
Right.
So, anyway, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but
well, no, I appreciate an honest answer, because I kind of came across to me as a little bit of a conflict, but I appreciate you answering openly answering the question. I mean, it's these issues are tough. It's always used against anybody who's talking about alternative therapy, that you're in it for the money, you're being paid to do this or something like mm-hmm. that. So I think it's important to be very sensitive about this. We've almost run out of time, but what is the scoop with your new movie, The God Cells? That's the title of the movie.
Yep.
When is it going to be available to the public?
Well, it's available now as of February. It hit Amazon Prime streaming in four countries. It's interesting. This has been the most challenging movie to promote. I'm not quite entirely sure why, other than the obvious, like the abortion issue, et cetera. Like my usual allies, like, I won't say who they are, but like people that really supported me as far as the big entities in the world of medicine that have kind of helped me get my films known, they won't touch this because of the abortion issue specifically. They're afraid of kind of angering half of their audience because it is so polarizing. It's like, I think it's easily half the population of America either agrees or disagrees with the whole act of abortion. So your question is kind of been creeping along. You know, all my movies took a little time to like really catch hold. Second Opinion, the first year, didn't really gain traction until about a year after it was out. So we're only talking about a few months since this has been out. So, you know, it's now June. It just released in February. And kind of 3 years of my life, this film.
Okay. Well, we really need to end this because I really have run out of time. But thank you for joining me, Eric. I appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Okay. Goodbye.
All right. Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 146 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.